You'll remember that where we got to last week in finishing off the book of Jeremiah is, of course, Israel has already gone into captivity, 722, and now Judah has been captured by the Babylonians, and they are going into captivity into Babylonia, and this is about 586, the destruction of the temple. And you remember we gave this little map when we were in the book of Jeremiah. And what happens is the Babylonians come in. And finally, they've been devastating the whole land, destroying cities, taking over everywhere. And finally, they take Jerusalem and they knock down its buildings, they knock down its walls, and they knock down the temple. And then they take the people captive in chains. They're all bound in chains up here to Ramah, where they're in kind of a holding camp, ready to go off to Babylon. And it's probably at this point that Jeremiah is looking back at Jerusalem and begins to write the book of Lamentations. This lament over the destruction of the city. It's happened now. And either, you know, he is at Ramah reflecting on the scene of devastation, or he's on his way. We don't know. But the Babylonians have now leveled Jerusalem, and that's where we come into Lamentations. Now, in Jeremiah 18:18, I've mentioned this before, you get three streams of material in the Old Testament, and you'll see them actually itemized there in Jeremiah 18:18. Just happens to mention, and notice, the context is against Jeremiah. That's not important. Then they said, come, let us devise plans against Jeremiah. But what they say is, surely the law is not going to be lost to the priest. And so the stream of the law ran through the priest who was the teacher in Israel, nor counsel to the wise or to the sage. So there was a stream of wisdom represented in books like Proverbs, or the divine word to the prophets. And we've said before that in the Old Testament you get these three streams that make up the 39 books of the Old Testament. You've got 17 books of law and history, you've got 5 books of wisdom, and you've got 17 books of prophecy. It's easy to remember. And so this stream is going to be picked up by the priests, who are the teachers in Israel. This stream is going to be picked up by the men of wisdom, often the counselors to the kings, of course Solomon representing the great wisdom tradition, this stream being picked up by kings, counselors, and sages, and then the final stream, that of prophecy or the seer's revelation. Now Lamentations is interesting because it actually is a blending of all those three streams. And so in Lamentations, it is actually a liturgical poem. The whole thing is a poem, and we'll see that in a moment, or a poem set to song. And so it was used in the temple and is still read every year by the Jews on a certain day of the year, and we'll come to that. And so it's a liturgical poem. It's also wisdom material because it's speaking about the mystery of suffering, much like the book of Job. And then, of course, it's prophetic because there's a note of the hope of restoration. So everything has been leveled, but there's hope in the book of Lamentations. And so it shares all those three streams in the scriptures. Lamentations was found at Qumran, the Dead Sea Scrolls, and here in fact is a piece of Lamentations from the 1st century BC. This is not a copy, this is an actual document. And it's a little hard to read, but you can just recognize the Hebrew letters running along here. Of course, I should go this way, running along here, okay, and running along here. And this is Lamentations from one of the, actually, Cave 4 of the Dead Sea Scrolls. And it's wonderful that at this time, of course, they were writing, remember what they were writing on at this point in their history? It was parchment, which was usually sheep or goat skin, and just lasts for a long, long time, particularly in a dry place, particularly in a... So this has lasted, of course, for over 2,000 years, so it's what we have here is a BC document, not a copy, but a BC document. Wonderful that we know the accuracy of the Bible. It's rather nice that they used papyrus, because the earliest books, of course, this is a scroll, and you know, a scroll, you rolled up, and you know, then you had to kind of unroll it. It was difficult to handle, you know. If you let go, you know, it would go ping, and it would all go shut. So you've unrolled, you know, the 52 chapters, and you know, you sneeze and let go, and you've lost it. And so books are what was called eventually a codex. They had books. This is the earliest books that have ever been found, and this is 14 centuries BC. This is hugely ancient. This is the oldest form of book in the world. There's only one problem. They had a great idea, and what they would do is that they would open it up, and they would pour wax in here, and they'd pour wax in here, and then they'd write into the wax. Which is great, except, you know, you write this, you know, wonderful, you know, love letter to your wife, and then if it's a hot day, you know what happens? You know, by the time she picks it up, it had melted. And so this was a great form of book, but it didn't have much longevity. And so papyrus was used, and then parchment was used, and parchment in a dry climate lasts for a long, long time. Okay, Lamentations introduction. Let me just read verse 1, and then we'll read the introductory sheets. Lamentations 1:1, and you can imagine Jeremiah now. He's looking back at the city that represents Jerusalem, and he says, "How lonely sits the city that was full of people. She has become like a widow who was once great among the nations. She who was a princess among the provinces has become a forced laborer." So he begins to work into this wonderful but tragic lament, and we'll be looking at those verses. But I want to just say a few things. Lamentations was read on the ninth month of Av, which is July-August on the lunar calendar, on which it's interesting, both the first temple, okay, so here, this is the first temple built by Solomon, was destroyed, and then in 70 AD, of course, the second temple was destroyed on exactly the same dates, which is interesting because it shows that even when the enemy gets the upper hand, God is in control. And so on exactly the same dates, and it's read on those dates by the Jewish community even today, remembering and lamenting the destruction of the temple. The author's identity is suppressed. We know it's Jeremiah, but he never says so, because he's a representative figure who articulates the grief of the whole nation. And so he's not speaking as an individual, he's verbalizing the grief of the whole of Jerusalem. So if you look at chapter 1 and verse 11, the second half of verse 11 and 12, and it says, "See, O Lord, and look, for I am despised." It's not Jeremiah. He's personifying Jerusalem. "Is it nothing to you who pass this way? look and see if there was any pain like my pain. So it's Jerusalem smoking in ruins, this beautiful city leveled, devastated, kind of like Nuremberg or one of the German cities that's flattened. And he speaks, he gives voice to the city. Is it nothing to you who all who pass this way? Look and see if there was any pain like my pain, which was severely dealt out to me, which the Lord inflicted on the day of his fierce anger. So Jeremiah is not talking about his personal pain. He is articulating, he's personifying the pain of the city. Thirdly, there's an interesting rhythm in Jeremiah. It's called the quinta meter, and it's used, and it's associated with the funeral laments. And this is where it's always a little sad that we can't read things in the original. And because in the Hebrew it has an uneven metrical structure which gives a kind of halting, choking and sobbing sense to the text, possibly even suggesting the kind of gates, the limping gait of a funeral procession. And we can't get that in the English, but you need to, it's almost like somebody is crying when you read this in the Hebrew. It's almost like somebody is choking, can hardly get it out. Fourthly, Lamentations is unique because it's written after the destruction of the city. The other prophets, okay, Isaiah, Amos, etc., describe what would happen. Even Jeremiah is describing what would happen, but Lamentations, it's now happened. It's a little bit like, you know, us describing, you know, what would happen, you know, if an atomic bomb was dropped, you know, on LA or somewhere, you know, and we would all know that would really be terrible. But it would be a whole different thing if you visited LA after an atomic bomb had been dropped. You see what I mean? And so now he's seeing it, he's feeling it, he's overwhelmed. Before they'd just been saying, folks, you better repent, this is what's going to happen. But now it's happened, and that's his grief. And then only in the book of Job are such graphic and fierce descriptions used to characterize the actions of the Lord against Israel. If you look at 2:4 in your text, chapter 2 and verse 4, you'll see some of this. 2:4, and it says, this is the Lord against his people. And you remember Jeremiah uses the word, Israel is my precious child. But now, chapter 2 and verse 4, he has bent his bow like an enemy. He has set his right hand like an adversary and slain all that were pleasant to the eye. This is heartbreaking. In the tent of the daughter of Zion, he has poured out his wrath like fire. The Lord has become like an enemy. Notice, like an enemy. Okay, only like an enemy, because of course he'll redeem this, and he has swallowed up Israel. And God, of course, was grieving even as he allowed the Babylonians to come in. Next, I say Lamentations uses Adonai 32 times. Anybody know what Adonai means? One of the words for God. Remember? Adonai. It's a kind of generic word. It just means Lord or Master. Doesn't have any particular covenant connotations. It was used in the region. You know, just like we might use the word God. Do you see what I mean? It doesn't have any, you know, G-O-D. It's not univocal. It means many things to many people. So Adonai is just a word for God. So it uses that 32 times. But it uses Yahweh only 14 times. And it seems that it's easier for the author to use the more general term, Adonai, for the one who's inflicting the destruction on Jerusalem, than to use the name Yahweh, which was their personal covenant-keeping savior. A little bit like, you know, if your dad became the mayor, and then, you know, he was really draconian and terrible, and, you know, no one liked him, and you might refer to him as the mayor rather than as your dad. You know, you just, that's a more comfortable word. And that's what's happening here in the book of Lamentations. And importantly, the rabbis saw the weeping of Jeremiah in Lamentations as the weeping of the Lord himself. So if you turn to 1:16, and this is very important, and I've said it before, when we read Jeremiah, and even when we read Lamentations, 1:16, "For these things I weep, my eyes run down with water, because far from me is a comforter, one who restores my soul. My children are desolate, because the enemy has prevailed." And these are the words of Jeremiah, but the prophet has no independent emotional life. He's supposed to be just echoing the heart of God. And the rabbis always would say, these are the tears of God. It's the same if you go over to chapter 2 and verse 11. We could go many places in Lamentations. But 2:11, "My eyes fail because of tears. My spirit is greatly troubled. My heart is poured out on the earth because of the destruction of the daughter of my people." And so this is the tears of Jeremiah, but he only incarnates the tears of the Lord, the tears of the Lord. And then I've put Lamentations is a foreshadowing of God's judgment on Jesus. We'll work our way into this. And its canonical order is at the midpoint of the major prophets. Now here's what's very interesting. You know, the Hebrew Old Testament does not run in the same order as our Old Testaments. This is the Hebrew classification, and this is the arrangement in your Old Testaments. Now, the Jews have real insight here. And I've mentioned before that Joshua, Judges, Samuel, Kings, they don't call history as we do. They call it prophecy. Do you remember why? Remember why? Because, you see, it's not straight history. It's not straight history. You can't, for instance, in the book of Joshua, put all that huge amount of material into just a book of, what, about 24 chapters. You can't do it. I mean, imagine a book on the Civil War, you know, 5,000 pages or whatever, volumes. And so it's prophetic in as much as Joshua is saying something. It's not just telling us a bit of history, it's saying something prophetic. And that's why they called these the former prophets, because they said this is prophetic history. Okay, it's not just a record of events and kings and dates. It's actually compiled to say something theological. So often their order is very interesting, ending with Chronicles, and Chronicles begins with Adam and ends at the end of the Old Testament. So it's a great place to put Chronicles. However, they put Lamentations in here, okay, in the writings, and we put Lamentations, I believe, correctly, right in the middle of the major prophets between Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Daniel. And I think we put it there in the light of Christ. And you'll see what I mean. If you look on that sheet, that Lamentations introduction, you'll notice down at the bottom there, I've put Isaiah, he's the prophet of incarnation, unto us a child is born, okay, unto us a son is given, etc. A virgin will conceive and bear a child. Jeremiah is the prophet who foreshadows the rejection of Jesus. Remember John 1:1, and he came unto his own, and his own received him not. But Lamentations is the prophet who foreshadows the judgment of God, the cross. And we'll see that as we move through. Ezekiel is the prophet of resurrection, valley of dry bones, resurrection, etc., and of glory and of the Spirit. And we have more about the glory of God and the Spirit of God in Ezekiel than any other book. And so we've got incarnation, we've got rejection, we've got the cross right in the middle, because we know it is the centerpiece of what God has done in history. Then Ezekiel, Pentecost, glory and the Spirit. Then Daniel. And Daniel is not about Israel. Daniel is about the kingdom in the nations. And so it's placed at a very strategic point in our Bible. And you can probably only place it there in the light of Christ, which is what the church has done. And they've done a good job, and we'll see why that is so important as we go on. I've said lastly on that page, the Hebrew name of the book is Echa, the word of lament. And actually, again, you lose it. Turn to chapter 1 and verse 1. Chapter 1 and verse 1. And I'll just show you how this works. We've translated it. How does the NIV read the first line? Chapter 1, verse 1. Okay, we just use the word how, but Echa is how terrible, how awful, how unbelievable. It's a kind of exclamation of this cannot be. And so reading 1:1 in Hebrew, it would be how terrible. The city sits lonely that was full of people. And again in chapter 2 and verse 1, turn there. This is how it would read in Hebrew 2:1. How terrible, how awful, how unbelievable. The Lord has covered the daughter of Zion with a cloud of his anger. Cloud of his anger. And then in chapter 4 and verse 1. Chapter 4 and verse 1. Same thing again. Echa. How terrible. How awful. How unbelievable, we would say. The gold has become dark. The pure gold has changed. And the sacred stones, the gold from the temple, etc., are poured out at the corner of every street. It's just saying, how can this be? And so we just get the little word how, but this is, how can this be? And this is this almost the weeping that's going on in the hearts of Jeremiah. And then over the page, and just the middle paragraph there, just say this final thing. If you turn to 4:12, chapter 4 and verse 12, it's very interesting, 4:12. It says, the kings of the earth did not believe, nor did any of the inhabitants of the world, that the adversary and the enemy could enter the gates of Jerusalem. Now, of course, Israel never believed that the Babylonians could come in. That's why they rejected Jeremiah. They said, this is the terrestrial, you know, dwelling place of God, the God of the whole earth. His ark is here, his temple is here, his throne is here. How can the pagans come in? But it's interesting here, it says that even the kings of the earth didn't believe that Jerusalem could be, and it might have been because they had heard of what God had done to Pharaoh, how he brought these people out. They had heard of the miracles of the living God happening in the land of Judah, and perhaps even they doubted that they could get in there. But the unbelievable, the unthinkable has happened, and this is why Lamentations has been written. I'd just like you to turn to the sheet that says the function of a lament, because we're not terribly familiar with laments in our culture. Not very familiar with it. But a lament is very, very important. Very important. And we would do well to recover the laments in our culture. I've put firstly, the lament is to incarnate, okay, to incarnate the grief of God, okay? And that's what's happening there. Now you might say, it's Jeremiah's grief, it's Jerusalem's grief. Yes, but God is grieving, God is the great griever. And so Jeremiah's tears mirror the tears of God for his precious child Israel. Just as the tears of Jesus over Jerusalem were the tears of God over his chosen people. Okay? And the prophetic task was not just to bring words from God, but in their grief, tears, and laments to incarnate the emotions of God in the midst of his people. And so a lament incarnates something of the grief of God. But then it does some other things as well. it kind of makes the pain and suffering more bearable. This is why people often write poetry in a time of tribulation. Have you noticed that? Poems are often written in a time of distress. And I was trying to think of a modern day lament. And I was kind of thinking, you know, what is something we would relate to? And then suddenly I realized the old Negro spirituals were laments. When their situation was utterly hopeless, you know, they saw no possibility of emancipation, no possibility of anything better for their children. So what would they do? They would sing. Now I asked Randall if she could find something that was at least, if it wasn't a Negro lament, came close to it. Now, whether this is a true lament or not, I don't know, but it will give you the feel. Why I did that is that that's not quite Lamentations, because it would have been more in a kind of Hebraic, you know, meter. But you can begin to get something from the Negro spirituals, you know, soon, you know, our troubles will be over. And this kind of, it's therapeutic, you know, if you can't do anything else, you know, you can sing out your grief. And that's what Lamentations is, and it's a shame that we don't know how it was sung. And it's a shame we can't read it in this almost sobbing, you know, grieving form. But that's somehow it would come across. And of course, much poetry in the English language picks up the lament form. And in fact, just to give an example, I won't read it all, but this is a poem by Emily Bronte, and somebody who either she or she's writing it on behalf of somebody else. This is a young woman, and the person she loves has died. And this is just English poetry, but again you can hear what a lament is. And she says, "Cold in the earth, and the deep snow piled above thee, far, far removed, cold in the dreary grave, have I forgot my only love to love thee, severed at last by time's all-severing wave. Sweet love of youth, forgive if I forget thee, while the world's tide is bearing me along. Other desires and other hopes beset me, hopes which obscure but cannot do thee wrong. But when the days of golden dreams had perished, and even despair was powerless to destroy, then did I learn how existence could be cherished, strengthened and fed, without the aid of joy. Then did I check the tears of useless passion, she means grief, weaned my young soul from yearning after thine, sternly denied its burning wish to hasten down to the tomb already more than mine. And even yet I dare not let it languish, dare not indulge in memory's rapturous pain, once drinking deep of that divinest anguish, how could I ever seek the empty world again? Not quite a lament, but often through history, you know, when there is, as it were, no light at the end of the tunnel, when we're engulfed in tragedy, often people use some sort of poetic lament. And that's what Lamentations is. And as I say, it's a shame we can't sing it, we can't hear it read as Jeremiah would have read it. Now turn back to chapter 1, and I want to show you the structure of Lamentations. Whoops, I didn't quite finish with the function of a lament here. I'll just go through that sheet that you've got. I've said to incarnate the grief of God, to make the pain and suffering more bearable, to express personal repentance or corporate repentance if sin is involved. That's Psalm 51, you see, is David's laments. Against thee only have I sinned, O God, create in me a clean heart. Because what he had done, of course, it's poetic, because he had put Uriah to death, you know, and Uriah was one of his mighty men, you know, and he's saying, Lord, you know, I've only sinned against you. He's using the lament form because it's such a sin against God. He doesn't mean that he has not, you know, slain Uriah, one of his mighty men, but it is a lament. And then one of the lovely laments in the Bible is, you remember when Saul and Jonathan die. You remember that? It's in the beginning of 2 Samuel. You needn't turn there. But this is one of the beautiful laments in the Bible. David discovers that Saul and Jonathan have died. And it says, and then David chanted with this lament over Saul and Jonathan his son. And you remember the words, he says, your beauty, O Israel, is slain on your high places. How the mighty have fallen. And again, it's a poem. How the mighty have fallen in the midst of the battle. Jonathan is slain on your high places. I'm distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. You have been very pleasant to me. Your love to me was more wonderful than the love of women. How have the mighty fallen, and the weapons of war perished. And when you read that lament, you can feel the tears of David. And so it expressed grief and brought healing. And then, lastly, it's to capture in poetry and song the pathos that's difficult to express in narrative form. Now, the interesting thing is that in 2 Kings 25, 2 Chronicles 36, Jeremiah 39, and Jeremiah 52, it's all about the destruction of Jerusalem, and everything is described, but it's rather clinical, you know, it's like reading the newspaper, and we go through some things, and reading the facts is not enough. We have to weep it out, to get healing, and that's what a lament is. But I want to show you how this is brought out very, very beautifully in the structure. And as you know, now turn to chapter 1 of Lamentations, okay, and how many verses do we have in chapter 1? How many?
22.
Okay, look in chapter 2, how many verses do we have?
22.
Okay, now chapter 3 is the climax, and I'll explain that in a moment. How many verses do we have? Okay, 3 times 22, 66, okay. Chapter 4, how many verses do we have?
22.
Chapter 5, how many verses do we have?
22.
How many letters in the Hebrew alphabets? Good guess. That's right, 22. 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet. And this is an acrostic. This is an acrostic. And what that means is if you turn again to chapter 1, I'll show you how this functions. Chapter 1. You see, again, you can't get it in the English Bible because when we translate, we lose the alliteration. But verse 1, okay, of chapter 1 of Lamentations would begin, okay, with the letter Aleph, Aleph. Verse 2 would begin with the letter Bet. Verse 3 with the letter Gimel. Verse 4 with the letter Dalet. That's how it would begin. As I say, you can't transliterate it into English because of the translation. And so every verse began with a different letter of the Hebrew alphabet, as it were, from A to Z, or as we say in England, from A to Z. Same in chapter 2. And so 2:1 begins with Aleph. 2:2, same thing, begins with Bet. 2:3 begins with Gimel. And so we have a straight acrostic. Now in chapter 3, and this becomes very, very important, we have a triple acrostic. And I'll explain what we mean. So in now if you've got an NIV, this is actually set out in groups of three, if you've got an NIV. Set out in groups of three. You've got a little break between each of the three verses. And so here, there's an intensification, okay, because verse 1 begins with Aleph, verse 2 begins with Aleph, verse 3 begins with Aleph, okay, so you've got the acrostic, but it's intensified by coming now in a group of three. And so verse 4, 5, and 6 all begin with the letter Bet, or Al-B, and then 7, 8, and 9, okay, all begin with Gimel. And so you go through the same pattern of 22, but it's intensified threefold. And then it's the same in chapter 4. Verse 1 again begins with Aleph, verse 2 with Bet, through the 22 verses. And the same with chapter 5, except chapter 5 is not actually an acrostic. To make up the acrostic structure, we have 22 verses, but it's not actually in an acrostic form, but it follows the 22 verses. Now, why do we need all that? Why do you normally have an acrostic? Okay, so I'm trying to think of a acrostic. It's just trying to think of an acrostic that spells something. But you know what I mean. You know, people make up all these acrostics. Now, normally an acrostic is for memorization, but in this case it's not. It's just what it is doing here. It's like this devastation of Jerusalem is so complete. It's like we've got to grieve from Alpha to Omega. We've got to grieve, you know, from A to Z. We've got to grieve all the way through, as it were, from beginning to end. And so the thought here is not so much memorization. It's just to say, this is as wide and as deep as grief can get. This is the A to Z of grief. And that's why it's in this form. Now, what gets very interesting, and I'll show you this in a minute, of course, in a book of five chapters, chapter 3 is in the middle. And we'll find that chapter 3, which foreshadows the cross and the resurrection, is both the numeric and the thematic center of the book. Okay? And not only chapter 3, the very middle of chapter 3. And we'll find that is beautifully balanced. And so what we find here is if you look at it, is chapter 1, we go from the kind of A to Z of grief all the way through, 22 verses. Chapter 2, again. Chapter 3, there's an intensification. We go through it three times, 66 verses. Chapter 4, we go through it again. Chapter 5, we go through it again. But of course what it means is we've got the acrostic, the 22 times 7. So it's a kind of comprehensive and exhaustive suffering, not just from A to Z, okay? Not just from Alpha to Omega, not just from Aleph to Tav in the Hebrew alphabet, but we've got to go through it 7 times. We've got to, you see, this is Holocaust theology. This is Holocaust theology. And what do you do if you're in Auschwitz? What can you do? You can't understand it. You can't rationalize it. But you can use lamentations to get out your grief. And of course, that's what they did. That's what they did. It's served wonderfully. But what I want to show you, and we'll look at this actually in the text, is I've mentioned that the exact numerical midpoint of the book, it's not only the numerical midpoint, but it's the thematic midpoint as well. We get into not only the cross, but into resurrection. And so when you get into chapter 3, and I'll show this to you, okay, now how many acrostics do we have in chapter 3? Okay, they're doubled up in threes. Okay, so we've got the 22 acrostics, but each one is 3 verses. Okay? And so when we get to the middle of chapter 3, okay, now it's a 5-chapter book, so this is the middle. But you get into chapter 3, okay, and what's the middle of chapter 3? Okay, if there's 22 acrostics, acrostic 11 and acrostic 12 are in the exact center of the book. And it's here, okay, acrostic 11 and acrostic 12, that we begin to get the heart of the cross and the hope of the resurrection. And so hope and optimism begin to break through. And so you've got a book that's beautifully constructed, both to highlight the extent of grief. But for us, we see in the judgment on Jerusalem, we begin to see a paradigm of the cross. And Lamentations has always been used by the church in Holy Week, always, because we see the cross and the resurrection in Lamentations, and I'll show that to you in just a minute. Is there any pain like my pain? Chapter 1, Jerusalem is mourning her destruction. The Lord has become like an enemy. It's not an enemy, but like an enemy. Chapter 2. Chapter 3, the center, okay, the center. The author speaks as Jerusalem, or if you like, as every man. Just like Adam represents every man, okay, the first Adam, just like Christ represents every man, the last Adam, so Jeremiah now gives voice to a corporate entity, Jerusalem, and speaks in that way. And then chapter 4, the limit of suffering, and chapter 5 is a prayer for restoration. As I've said, it's not actually an acrostic, although it follows the acrostic pattern of 22 verses. And I've mentioned the author takes different vantage points, sometimes speaking as Jerusalem, sometimes looking on as a bystander, and sometimes speaking as every man. And you'll see that in chapter 3, verse 1. He's saying, I'm the man who has seen affliction because of the rod of his wrath. Now he's speaking as Jerusalem. You see, he's personalizing, because of course a city is not buildings, a city is people. And so he's saying, he's verbalizing, he's given personhood to Jerusalem. I'm the man, Jerusalem, who has seen affliction because of the rod of his wrath. But who personalizes the human race? Okay, and it's so easy, isn't it? So easy. These are the words of Jesus. And we'll see that in just a moment. And so what we've come to here, let's just look through the text, and I'll show you a few verses, because I want to really get into chapter 3, which is the cross and the resurrection. But let me give you a feel of the book. And so turn to chapter 1, a few verses. I read verse 1. Notice chapter 1 and verse 4. It says, "The roads of Zion are in mourning." What beautiful poetry. Even the roads are mourning, because no one comes up to the great feasts at Jerusalem. So it's like the roads are mourning because the pilgrims are not walking over them on the way up to the feast. And then verse 11, "All her people groan, seeking bread, and they have sold their precious things for food." And we'll see that that gets even worse a little bit. And then over the page, perhaps we'll go to chapter 2, which is very interesting. How the Lord has covered the daughter of Zion with a cloud in his anger. And in chapter 2, in the first four verses, the word anger comes five times in four verses. How the Lord has covered, and again it's how terrible. The Lord has covered the daughter of Zion with a cloud of anger. He has cast her from heaven to the earth, the glory of Israel, and has not remembered his footstool in the day of his anger. Jerusalem has been cast down from heaven. And then verse 3 is interesting, because we can learn from this. And there are three things in verse 3. It says, the first phrase, "In fierce anger he has cut off all the strength of Israel." And the first evidence of God's anger in the church is a lack of power. Do you notice that? The first evidence of God's anger, we're very slow to realize we're coming under God's anger. The first evidence is that there's a lack of power in the church. He has cut off the strength of Israel. Next phrase, he has drawn back his hand from before the enemy. And the second evidence of the anger of God, okay, is that the enemy is not held back. And you see all kinds of people, you know, just being devastated by all kinds of enemy attack. And you think, hey, aren't we supposed to be under the shadow of the Almighty? Yes. But you see, the Lord not hold is like Saul. An evil spirit comes upon him, okay, because God has withdrawn his hand. Okay, and then thirdly, again in verse 3, an evidence of the Lord's anger is that his holiness in our midst becomes destructive. And so it says he has burned in Jacob. Well, the burning of the Lord is purifying, it's Pentecost. But he's burned in Jacob like a flaming fire consuming roundabouts. And so what happens, you see, is we get now an Ananias and Sapphira. You see, and this burning love now becomes destructive. And so the third evidence of the Lord being angry with his people is that his holiness becomes destructive, the judgment. And then in verse 4, he has bent his bow like an enemy. He has set his right hand like an adversary. Notice, he is not an enemy, he is not an adversary, but is acting as one. And the slain, all that were pleasant to the eye in the tents of the daughter of Zion, he has poured out his wrath like fire. The Lord has become like an enemy, and he has swallowed up Israel. Verse 6, and notice this, this was unbelievable, inexplicable, and he has dealt violently and treated his tabernacle like a garden shack, like a tool shed. He has destroyed his appointed meeting place. So not even the temple has been spared. Verse 7, the Lord has rejected his altar, he has abandoned his sanctuary, and has delivered it to the hand of the enemy. And so the candlestick has been removed. And we should have reverent fear, because there are days in the church where the Lord says, I'll remove the candlestick. And that has happened in history. Okay? And God says, I will not own this any longer. I won't lend my name to this any longer. And so Judah has to go. Judah has to go because God will not lend his name. And that's why the Lord's Prayer that we're supposed to pray every day, okay, our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, you see. And when wickedness is operating, God says, I will not lend my name to this any longer because I need to hallow my name. People need to know that the name of God is a good name. It's not associated with pollution, corruption, violence, and sin. Okay? And then just a couple of other verses. Verse 15 of chapter 2, just giving you the feel, really, giving you the feel of this. All who pass along the way clap their hands joyfully or in derision at you. They hiss and shake their heads at the daughter of Jerusalem. And they say, is this the city of which they said, the perfection of beauty, a joy to all the earth? You see, the enemy knew that was what Jerusalem was meant to be, the perfection of beauty, a joy to all the earth. And now it is leveled. It is flattened, it is smoking, it is destroyed. And then what must we do? Verse 18, this is important. This is important. Middle of the verse, this is 2:18. Let your tears, now this is instruction, let your tears run down like a river day and night, and give yourself no relief. Let your eyes have no rest. Arise, cry aloud in the nights. At the beginning of the night watches, pour out your heart like water before the presence of the Lord. Now what's interesting here, okay, is that they go into captivity. Here's Judah going into captivity in 586, okay? Already over here is a man called Daniel, okay? Because he went into captivity perhaps in around 605, an early wave. He's already there. And so what does Jeremiah say? He says, well, nothing can be done, folks. You know, you just got to accept it. No, let your tears run down like a river. Cry aloud in the nights. At the beginning of the night watches, pour out your heart like water. Now, they go into captivity in 586, and remarkably, it shouldn't have happened, remarkably, this great power of Babylon falls. Shouldn't have fallen, okay? Assyria is gone, and this rather insignificant power called Persia arises. And a remarkable thing happens in the first year of Cyrus, Persia. He says, you know, I think I should allow the Jews to go back home. How extraordinary. Why? Because Daniel, okay, captivity was in 586. This is now Cyrus comes to the throne in 538. And so what Daniel has been doing is praying for 48 years. Because that's what Jeremiah says. That's our only hope. So our tears aren't just the tears of grief. Our tears are the tears of intercession. Arise, cry out in the nights. At the beginning of the night watches, pour out your heart like water. And remember, what did Daniel do three times a day? Okay, and opened his windows, you remember, towards Jerusalem. That's right, because he had read the book of Jeremiah. We'll skip chapter 3 because I want to finish there. But just again, giving you a feel, chapter 4, let's pick up a couple of verses in chapter 4 and chapter 5. Okay, 4:6. Jeremiah says, for the iniquity of the daughter of my people is greater than the sin of Sodom. How can this be? How can this be? Not even equal, greater than the sin of Sodom. And then verse 10, the hands of compassionate women boiled their own children. They became food for them in this terrible siege that they were living through. It's a terrible, terrible, terrible day. Verse 19 of chapter 4, our pursuers were swifter than the eagles of the sky. They chased us on the mountains. They waited in ambush for us in the wilderness. The breath of our nostrils, the Lord's anointed, was captured in their pits, because Israel is the Lord's anointed. of whom we had said, notice, this was our boast, under his shadow we will live among the nations. Because they weren't frightened. They weren't frightened by Assyria or Babylon or Persia or Greece or Egypt, because they will live under his shadow in the midst of the nations until they sinned and God had to withdraw his protection and they were no longer under his wings. Then chapter 5 is very interesting because it's a prayer. 5:1 starts to pray, "Remember, O Lord, what has befallen us. Look and see our reproach." Verse 11, "They ravished the women in Zion, the virgins in the city of Judah. Princes were hung by their hands. Elders were not respected," etc. And verse 16, "The crown has fallen from our head. Woe to us, for we have sinned." Now, when you start to use this kind of language, there's hope, and we'll see that in a moment. But the book ends with a very interesting ending. "Thou, O Lord," verse 19, "Thou, O Lord, dost rule forever, thy throne from generation to generation. Why dost thou forget us forever? Why dost thou forsake us for so long?" So a question is being asked, okay? Is there a way, this is the question, is there a way in which God can reign in righteousness? And he says, "Lord, you rule forever, your throne, you've got to reign." But is there a way God can rule in righteousness but still restore us? Verse 21, "Restore us, O Lord, that we may be restored. Renew us." Is there a mechanism where God can be just and yet show mercy? Where God can be just and judge and yet restore his people? It's a great question, and we know the answer. And it doesn't end in certainty. Okay, verse 22, because the cross has not happened, it's still promise, unless thou hast utterly rejected us and art exceedingly angry with us. In other words, we're left with uncertainty because that certainty will only be answered in the cross. Okay, so there's a question that Jeremiah wrestles with. He says, "Lord, I understand that you reign and you have to reign with justice. I understand that, Lord. But Lord, is it possible? Is it possible that there could be restoration? Is it possible that you could be just but also merciful?" And he wrestles with that. And that takes us to chapter 3. And that's where I want to finish today. And so what's happened, just to kind of give you a little roadmap here, I've mentioned that in the history of Israel, they're going in and out. And the history of Israel, really from Abraham to Jesus, can be summed up in, I've said before, 5 periods of 400 years. The patriarchal period is about 400 years. The Exodus, that's getting hold of Terah, then Abraham, moving through the patriarchs. Exodus, as we know, 400 years. Here they're coming in, here they're going out. After Exodus, they're coming in. Joshua through Solomon, they're getting established in the land. Okay, through Joshua, Judges, and then the golden age of Solomon. Solomon dies, okay, and after this roughly 400-year period, the kingdom is divided, and really, it's a movement out of the promises of God. They're not out of the land yet. 722, the north goes. 586, they really are out. Okay, they're out. But now, is there a possibility that there's going to be restoration? Can God really bring us in to all that he promised? And that is chapter 3 of Lamentations. So if you would turn there, I want to read it. And if you take this sheet, Lamentations as foreshadowing Jesus and the cross. And for us as Christians, this is the pinnacle of Lamentations. And I've put Israel, just follow with me now, because it will then make so much sense when we read chapter 3. Israel is concentrated down and is represented in Jerusalem and the temple, which are the core and epicenter of the nation. And so they saw Jerusalem as representing the nation, but even tighter than that, the temple represented who they were. So Jerusalem and the temple are then concentrated down further into one man, Jeremiah, the one faithful Israelite, and the innocent sufferer who symbolically bears their sin and will even end up in chains, will even end up in exile. He personifies Jerusalem. Then next paragraph, he foreshadows Jesus, the suffering servant, the faithful Israelite, who stands as the personification and perfection of all that Israel was meant to be. And as I've said before, Jesus is Israel. He is Jerusalem. He is the temple. Destroy this body, this temple, and in 3 days I'll raise it up. He is the fulfillment of its prophets, priests, and kings, the fullness of what was foreshadowed in temple, tabernacle, and sacrifice. And the judgment on Judah, Jerusalem, and the temple prefigures the judgment of Jesus on the cross. And we'll see this in chapter 3. And so you'll remember when we were in the second half of Isaiah, you remember the second half of Isaiah was 27 chapters, you'll remember, second half, broken down into 3 sections of 9, you'll remember, 3 sections of 9, and right in the middle again, we have Isaiah 53. And we said that Israel began as one man, Jacob, okay, and then Israel is focused down, Isaiah 53, into one man, Jesus. Of course, then it's going to be amplified back out again into his body, the church. And you get exactly the same pattern in Lamentations. And so I'll just read these points, then we'll conclude by reading chapter 3 in the light of them. Just as Jerusalem represented the glory and epicenter of who Israel was, so Jesus represents the glory and epicenter of the true Israel. Number 2, just as Jerusalem was the epicenter of the sins of Israel, so Jesus draws into himself the sins of Israel and, of course, the whole world, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. Just as the wrath of God fell on Jerusalem because of the sin of Israel, so the wrath of God fell on Jesus because of the sins of the world. 3:1, I am the man who has seen affliction because of the rod of his wrath. Point 4, just as the nation symbolized by Jerusalem will come back in resurrection, Ezekiel's vision, you remember, so Jesus will come back in resurrection. And then 5, just as the nations are impacted by the destruction of Jerusalem and the dispersion of Judah, so they're a blessing now wherever they go, through Daniel and others, so the nations will be impacted by the destruction of Jesus, the cross, and the dispersion of his disciples throughout the nation. The parallel only breaks down insofar as Israel was guilty and deserved punishment, and Jesus was innocent, but took on himself vicariously our guilt and our punishment. So turn to chapter 3, okay, and we'll read chapter 3, okay, through this lens now that we used before, seeing chapter 3 obviously as the middle of the book, 5 chapters, but then we're going to get right into the heart of chapter 3, the very verses Laura was referring to, and we'll see we get into the hearts of the cross and the resurrection. So Lamentations 3, reading it in the lights of the cross, and only the cross can validate the justice of God, but also make room for restoration and mercy. 3:1, I am the man who has seen affliction because of the rod of his wrath. That's the cross. He has driven me and made me walk in darkness and not in light. And so when Jesus is on the cross, what happens to the sun? That's right, doesn't shine. Verse 3, surely against me he has turned his hand repeatedly all the day. So from Gethsemane, you remember the day would begin in the evening, right through to Calvary, the cross. It's like he's turned his hand against me, and he weeps in the garden. Verse 4, he has caused my flesh and my skin to waste away, just like Job and the suffering servant of Isaiah 53. He has broken my bones, just like the walls of Jerusalem, the walls of the temple are broken down. And remember, this is Jerusalem, but through Jerusalem we're seeing the cross. Verse 8, even when I cry out and call for help, he shuts out my prayer. And so on the cross, Jesus will say, my God, why have you forsaken me? He shuts out my prayer. On to verse 14, I've become a laughingstock to all my people, and they mock me all the day. And so you remember in Matthew, those who passed by, it said, Matthew 27, they hurl insults at him, and it says that the chief priests and the scribes and the elders, they mocked him. They mocked him, Matthew 27. And he says, I'm a laughingstock to all my people. They mock me all the day. Then verse 15, he has filled me with bitterness. He has made me drink wormwood or gall. And you remember John 19, they gave him wine mixed with vinegar, gall, same word. Verse 19, remember my affliction, my bitterness, the wormwood and the bitterness, not just of the vinegar, but the bitterness of his rejection by his father. Verse 30, let him give his cheek to the smiter. Give him his cheek to the smiter. Echoes Isaiah 50. We looked at that a few weeks ago. I gave my back to those who strike me, and my cheeks, you remember, to those who pluck out the beard. And in Matthew 26 and Matthew 27, we see Jesus being smitten and his beard being plucked out, and his cheek, you remember, being smitten by the soldiers. And then finally, verse 53, we can't read it all. They have silenced me in the pits. They have placed a stone over me. So now they seek to silence the Son of God in the tomb and place a stone over him. And then verse 54, waters flowed over my head, which is an echo of Psalm 69, a messianic psalm. And you remember, Jesus says, I have a baptism to be baptized with. Okay, a baptism not of water, but of suffering. But it's like being engulfed, baptized in suffering. The waters is drowning in the water of suffering. But so you've got all that, you've got the cross. But then if you've got the cross, you've got to have the resurrection. And that's where, in the same passage, and this is what takes us now, this is where we creep towards, okay, the center of the center, okay? And we're going to look at acrostic 11 and acrostic 12, okay, right in the heart of chapter 3. And we're going to see that hope and optimism begin to break through. And so, yes, we have the cross, but where you have the cross, you've got something else. And so back up in chapter 3 to verse 21. Okay, this is in the midst, okay, of the judgment of God on Jerusalem, but echoing the cross. 3:21. This I recall to mind, and therefore I have hope. And in this chapter on the cross, the word hope will come four times. Why do I hope? Because the Lord has said, that's a covenant word, loving kindness, the Lord's hesed never ceases. It might seem that it has now, okay? The Son of God is on the cross. Jerusalem is in ruins. But the Lord's hesed, because it's a covenant commitment, never cease. His compassions never fail. They're new every morning. Great is thy faithfulness. Therefore, he's got to come out in resurrection, because God can't break his hesed, his covenants. It's going to be new. And so there's going to come an Easter morning because of the great faithfulness of God. And then we move verse 31, 32, and 33. That's acrostic 11. 34, 35, and 36 is acrostic 12. And so here we are, right in the middle of the middle, as it were. And you'll see how they read. You'll see how they read. Acrostic 11, verse 31. For the Lord will not reject forever. For if he causes grief, that's the cross, okay, that's his judgment on sin. If he causes grief, then he will have compassion according to his abundant hesed. So yes, there may be judgment on sin, on Jerusalem, and on the Son of God on the cross. But if he causes grief, he's going to have compassion. And so acrostic 12, verse 35, it says, he will not deprive a man of justice. Now he's speaking of as every man. He's speaking of us. We're in Christ. He will not deprive a man of justice. You see, the cross was the justice of God. Verse 36, and he won't defraud a man, and of course it's the man, Jesus, in his lawsuit. Of these things the Lord does not approve, because you see, the cross was God's lawsuit against sin and death, okay? It was his great challenge, okay, to bring his justice into, as it were, into the cosmic courts, and Jesus pays the price. And so now this man can't be defrauded in his lawsuits, because he's going to come out in resurrection, enabling us to go free. And so beautifully, right in the heart of the book, is tucked these great promises. Okay? Yes, there is the cross. Okay? But in the midst of the cross, we've got hope of restoration, resurrection, and the fulfillment of everything that Jerusalem was meant to be. God says it will be fulfilled in a very surprising way, because in 538, not many come back. Okay? But God has got something in his sleeve that is going to take out what Jerusalem was, the joy of the whole earth, of course, in Pentecost, is going to be taken out to the ends of the earth. And that is the hope that is right tucked into the center of this great lament of Israel.